So, friends, can I introduce to you, with great affection, our friend, author, theologian, speaker, broadcaster, Sheridan Voysey.
Members and senators, other distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for this opportunity of addressing you tonight. I've been looking forward to this event for quite some time. Thank you for the request from Stephen, from CSA, from all of your supporting organisations. I really am in awe of what you do, not just for your children, but for their families, not just for those families, but also for your communities. I have lived in three capital cities now, and I can confidently say to you tonight, dear friends, that Sydney wins the award for the most memorable public transport experiences. I was on the 436 bus heading into Sydney a little while back. It was a Monday morning, about 10:30. There were three of us on the bus. There was myself across the aisle. There was a girl wearing a Victoria Coffee t-shirt, obviously on her way to work. And then there was an old guy with a trolley bag. He sat just a seat away from me, and he desperately needed a bath. We were travelling on our way down Parramatta Road into Sydney when the bus pulled up to a mid-50s woman who obviously trolley man knew. She wore a faded floral dress. She had old beige comfortable shoes on. She hobbled onto the bus. Trolley man said hello. She ignored him and sat right next to him, right beside me. Totally empty bus. She also had what we could call a unique fragrance about her. And as I looked over at Victoria Coffee Girl, she was looking at me with a funny quirk on her face, looking at the empty bus and smiling and waving. And I wondered what I'd done to be so lucky. We continued down Parramatta Road in silence. Suddenly, floral lady sitting next to me did the most extraordinary thing. She thrust her face into my face. She was so close, the hairs on her chin nearly tickled me. Her eyes suddenly blared, her stained teeth were suddenly bared, and she yelled at me, "I'm all right, aren't I?" Now, I don't know about you, but I find it very difficult to respond to those kinds of questions. I jumped, my mind started racing as to what I was supposed to say in something like this, and then being the Bible college-trained, theologically-minded, wholeheartedly devoted Christian that I am, I did what anybody in my situation would do. I lied. I said, "Of course you're all right." She looked at me in the eye and she said, "Because some people think I'm funny in the head." And I said to her, "Now, why would they think that?" And she said, "I don't know." And she slipped into silence. I tried to engage her in a little bit more conversation, but she was gone, her thoughts away in the clouds. A little bit further on down the track, I was surprised when suddenly floral lady jumped up. She just got up. She went across the aisle. And out of the hundreds of empty seats that were in the bus, she sat next to Victoria Coffee Girl. I smiled and waved. Coffee Girl also tried to engage this woman in conversation, but to no luck. But then suddenly, floral lady did it to her. Eyes open, teeth bared. "I'm all right, aren't I?" Coffee Girl did the same kind of thing. She jumped. She looked for an answer. She said, "Of course you are. Some people think I'm funny in their head. Now, why would they think that?" The silence again ensued, and Coffee Girl had lost her because, again, Floral Lady was off in the clouds with her thoughts. She did pipe up a little bit later on when she said that she needed to get a monthly injection, but if truth were to be told, it really should be the doctor who should have that injection because I am all right, aren't I? And I wondered how many times that question would be asked during the rest of the day. And I wondered how deep was the anxiety in that woman's soul, who longed for assurance so desperately that she would go up to any stranger on the 436 bus travelling into Sydney on a Monday morning seeking it. And there's no doubt that my floral-dressed, freaky-smiled friend is a little bit out of the mainstream, that's for sure. But I don't think she's any different to any one of us. All of us have got questions deep on our hearts that we long to have answers for. They might be crowded out by the noise of life, and yet in the quiet times, maybe as we're lying in bed in the darkness waiting for sleep to fall, reflecting on the successes and failures of the day, they start to bubble up. Maybe they come in the quiet moments while we're sitting on the 436 bus in Sydney. They start to bubble up. and when we get to a stage where we can no longer ignore those questions any further, we go on a search looking for answers. George Bernard Shaw once said, if you want to understand a society, if you want to know what it thinks, look at what it searches for. Now, there's a real art to trend spotting in society, and I don't claim to have the talent in any great measure. But as I read, as I reflect, as I listen to the guests and the callers that we have on Open House, which are very varied and broad, and I thoroughly enjoy the program because of that fact, I get a feeling there's four questions that are on our soul. Four questions that are bubbling up on the soul of the nation, if you will. Four questions that are kind of inspiring and motivating some of the social trends that we actually see in our nation today. And I'd like to explore those four questions with you. Question number one that I believe we're asking in our nation at the moment, anxiously, you could put like this, in a materialistic world, where can I find meaning? We had the futurist Richard Watson on Open House a little while back. He's written a book called The Future Files. In that book, he's stated as one of his five big global trends, a renewed search for personal meaning. You don't have to reflect too far to think about maybe he might just be right. For instance, one of the greatest trends, one of the biggest kind of growth areas in the tourism market right now is voluntourism. Voluntourism is the gap year for adults, really. It's where you take your annual leave, but you don't go bobbing away in the nice, calm, iridescent blue waters of Lord Howe Island. You go to Tanzania and build an orphanage. You go to Guatemala and teach English. Australians are looking to do something meaningful with their vacations at the moment. As one journalist put it, volunteerism is what you do when sipping margaritas by the poolside loses its luster. Another trend we could look at is the growth of finding meaning in the workplace. The whole idea of workplace chaplains has developed over the last few years, so we're now starting to see chaplains actually assigned to various companies and workplaces. A variety of books and articles are coming out about the workplace of the future needing to be a place that doesn't just produce a product or give a service, but changes the world. I was talking to the responsibility manager for a large merchant bank who said, yes, I travel the world and I give money to worthy projects and things, and that's great. But look, in all honesty, one of the reasons why the company does it is staff retention. People today are spending so much time in the workplace. They want to feel at least their business is doing something meaningful, even if they aren't. You've heard of the midlife crisis. None of you have gone through a midlife crisis because I know you're all passionate people with great purpose and you've never kind of gone through a period of questioning in your life, right? Have you heard of the quarter life crisis? Some are calling it the thrisis. 20-somethings and 30-somethings who have grown up in nice economic times, have gotten good educations, developed great dreams for affluence and success, jumped into work and found that it's actually not that easy, started to swim in a sea of choice. You know, our generation today, we've got so many choices, which even some of the generations represented here didn't have, and certainly generations before us. And so they start to flounder. They start to experience something of a crisis of meaning. What's this all about? In her book on Generation Y, Rebecca Huntley, who is a researcher, talks about Generation Y as being rudderless. Not rudless, rudderless. Mr. Rudd is with us all the time. Rudderless. And here's the theory. Their parents, the boomers, let go of religion. And so what she is saying, Rebecca Huntley, as a mainstream researcher, that Generation Y, the 20-somethings of today, have grown up without any firm ethical base, any sense of purpose to guide them in their decision-making. And so, her words, they are lost, restless, and searching. Hence the quarter-life crisis. In a materialistic world, where can I find meaning? I asked Richard Watson, what might have catalyzed this renewed search for personal meaning, and he didn't know. Let me give it a try. I think the materialistic dream that was sold to us so captivated our imaginations that it set us on a pilgrimage to the kingdom of things. And when we arrived at the kingdom of things, we saw that it was beautiful and shiny and glitzy and sexy on the outside, but it was cold, it was empty, and it was lonely on the inside. And so we're starting to ask that question again. In the materialistic world, where can I find meaning? We certainly gave it a good try, though, didn't we? We did try the materialistic dream, not in half measures. The average Australian home since the 1950s has doubled in size, and yet we've got a third of the families living in them as we did back in the 50s. We've got twice the bathrooms, we've got three times the garages, a TV in every room, and fewer people actually using them. We've had the invention of the me ring. I wonder if you've heard of the me ring. A me ring is an engagement ring girls give to themselves as a gift of love. It goes on their right hand. One ad reads, "Your left hand says we, your right hand says me." I was walking through the Westfield Shopping Centre the other day, and there was an advertisement for gym equipment of all things, and the sign read, "Happiness, only $99. That's it, isn't it? We've tried to buy happiness, we've tried to buy significance, and we haven't been able to find it. And so we're left asking that question in a materialistic world. Where can I find meaning? I tell you, folks, it's not one of those questions that the guests on Open House have not asked before.
Brian Head Welsh is with us, originally from the band Korn.
I had all this money and this fame and stuff. When you could buy anything you want, any car, any house or whatever, you'd think that it would fulfill you, but it just didn't fulfill me. Yeah. And that confused me a lot.
We're talking to Marina Pryor on Open House tonight.
I sort of went on and did the big shows like Cats and Les Mis and Phantom of the Opera. So my profile became very high, and I had all the worldly things, the trappings of status and success, but I used to lie awake at 3 o'clock in the morning just feeling empty.
Anne Rice is our special guest.
There's a protest going on in those books. Lestat and Louis and Armand, the vampire heroes and heroines in those books, they protest. They shake their fists at the night and they say, "We want to find some meaning." And it's me sort of having a fight with myself. I became convinced early on that God didn't exist, and those books are about rebellion.
Gloria Gaynor, welcome to Open House.
And I have cars, jewelry, and I have furs, and I have everything that a person would call success, but I felt unfulfilled. I started on a quest to learn what it is that could possibly make a person feel fulfilled when they seemingly already have everything.
His name is Thomas Keneally.
Meaning is everything, and humans will never cease pursuing the question of meaning, nor should they. There's no escaping it wherever you go.
There's a popular personal development course that's getting around our capital cities at the moment. And the great crescendo at the end of the weekend is when participants are told, "Life is meaningless. So go and do what you want. Go and make it meaningful somehow. It's all up to you." What a burden to carry. It's enough to leave you weary. But folks, if you can hear it too, I can hear a voice whispering, "Come to me, all you who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest." Question number one, in a materialistic world, where can I find meaning? Question number two, on the nation's soul, as I hear it, in a confusing world, where can I find guidance? My wife was telling me about a colleague of hers who, in her loneliness one weekend, went for a walk down to the local fortune teller simply to have some company. She was looking for guidance. She was asking those questions. What does my future hold? Where am I going? Will I always be lonely? And she's not alone. We're looking for guidance. We are looking for somebody to give us some direction as to where we should go. This year alone, 65,000 people, predominantly 20 to 45-year-old women, will go through the 5 mind-body-spirit festivals that are held in Melbourne, Sydney and Brisbane every year. The organisers tell me that one of the most popular events of that event, one of the most popular features, if not the most popular feature, is the reading room, where 60 psychics ply their trade and give all of those women answers and guidance on love and money and happiness that they're looking for. 65,000 people just this year alone. It's not all New Age navel-gazing, though, I have to say, and it's not just females as well that are looking for guidance. What about the rise of life coaching over the last few years? You pay a life coach to give you guidance on setting goals and maintaining a positive outlook and keeping work-life balance. It's quite a trend. In fact, one institute actually suggests it is the second fastest growth industry in Australia right now. Life coaching. In its business form, it's becoming very popular to male executives. No problem with that. What I find really interesting is that often the guidance that's given kind of strays and moves off from just career goals and bottom line planning and things like that to spiritual guidance. Here's one testimonial. About a year ago, I began an inner spiritual journey to try and fill that emptiness we all feel at times in our lives. I had learned enough to know that it was me, not another person or thing, that was going to make me happy, but I was stuck there. I was led to Brooke, the life coach, through divine appointment. Of that I am sure. I now look at the event as a continuing, exciting adventure of discovery so that I can be the best me out in the world that I possibly can be. In a confusing world, where can I find guidance? Some are finding it in tarot cards, some are finding it in life coaches. I ask myself, what are we looking for? What are we really looking for? Where do we get guidance for our lives? I wonder if we're looking for a set of guiding values. A set of guiding values that perhaps the nihilistic philosophers of a previous age actually took away from us. You remember Nietzsche with his classic statement, God is dead? Remember John Paul Sartre, who came along after that, and he said, all we have left is the bare, valueless fact of existence? You think of Albert Camus, who came after that, and he said, if this is true, if there is no God and all we've got is the bare, valueless fact of existence, then the only serious question to ask is why we don't commit suicide. And as humans, funnily enough, have got an aversion to suicide, is it not any surprise that the generations that are now, I guess, taking up those values, who have been influenced by those values the most, I would suggest generations X and Y, are searching for something, are searching for some values to actually hold on to? Douglas Copeland, in his classic book, Generation X, describing my generation, said that my generation are looking for a set of small rules to help us cope with life, because there are no big rules left. Rebecca Huntley, go back to Generation Y. She talked about them being rudderless, about lacking any ethical direction, and so they're lost, they're restless, they're searching for something to give them. I would suggest we're looking for a set of guiding values so that we can decide in tune with those values. But I think there's something else we're looking for. I think we're looking for a guiding voice. A few years ago, I stood in the Sydney Domain listening to what the Dalai Lama had to say. 5,000 others stood around me in the pouring rain to hear what that man had to say. 5,000 people standing in the pouring rain. Last year, 20 million people signed up for Oprah's online course that she hosted with the popular New Age author Eckhart Tolle. 20 million, not a few from Australia. 20 million people. We're looking for a guiding voice as well, not just a set of abstract values that we can somehow make our decisions by. We're looking for a guiding voice. There's a band out, and probably the kids in your schools are listening to them. They're called Carolina Liar, and I think they bring this search for guidance quite nicely into a song they got out at the moment, where they sing this: save me, I'm lost. Oh Lord, I've been waiting for you. I'll pay any cost. Save me from being confused. Show me what I'm looking for. And folks, if you quieten down and if you strain that ear to hear, I wonder if you'll hear the voice of one saying, you will seek me and you will find me when you seek me with all of your heart. In a materialistic world, where do we find meaning? In a confusing world, where do I find guidance? In a broken world, where do I find liberation? And it is a broken world. 25 million children will die tonight from hunger and related causes. This year alone, 4 million women and girls will be sold into sexual slavery. It looks like we're heading towards an 8% unemployment rate in the coming months. Imagine living in Haiti, where it's 70% unemployment, 80% of the population living under the poverty line. Then we could talk about Darfur, and then we could talk about Zimbabwe, and we could talk about the global food crisis. There's another GFC out there, folks, the global food crisis that's happening right now. In our own country, we have to run ads to curb domestic violence. In our own country, 30% of us intake some sort of mood-altering substance just to get through the day. Alcohol, drugs, antidepressants, sleeping tablets. In our own country, docs cannot find enough foster carers to look after all the troubled kids on their books. We have got a broken nation as well. We've got a beautiful nation, an inspiring nation, a nation that I love being a part of, but we're broken. And so more and more people are asking this question: in a broken world, where do I find liberation? Look at the counselling professions and the growth of the counselling professions over the last decade. We're talking about life coaching being the second greatest growth industry in Australia. Counselling is actually the first, according to the ABS, growing by a rate of 200% more than any other profession at the moment. Counselling is taking off. We want to be released. We want to be liberated from our past hurts and our fears and our anxieties and the abuse that we've actually suffered. Then there's the secular confessional. You might have been to a church-based confessional. They're popping up as secular confessionals with telephone lines and websites. A few years ago, a guy by the name of Frank Warren handed out 400 postcards, blank postcards. He asked people to write down a secret on those postcards, illustrate it, and send it back to him. The kind of confessions he got were beyond what he ever expected. I haven't spoken to my dad in 10 years, and it kills me every day. Everyone who knew me before September 11 now believes I'm dead. When I was 4, I told my grandfather I hated him. He died before I could apologise. I'm still sorry for that. One of them reads, "I wish the drugs would stop working so I could cry again." Some are actually quite funny too. There was one who said, I got a parking ticket and so did the car next to me. I replaced the ticket on my car next to me with mine. Mine got paid and the one that I took, well, I'm sending it to you. So why is there this desire for us to confess, for us to get the stuff off our chest that we want to get off our chest? Why do we have that drive? Why that desire? All those 400 postcards came back and now Frank Warren receives 1,000 every week. That has spurred on a whole heap of new websites like airyoursins.com and notproud.com, where people air all sorts of dirty laundry. Yes, of course, some of it's voyeuristic. Yes, of course, some of the confessions are purely fabricated for titillation, but some of them have the ring of truth, like this woman who shared and confessed about cheating on her boyfriend and then said this, "I'm sorry. I don't believe in a God, but I feel I need to finally tell someone the truth, even if it's just the internet." Church going may stop. The belief in a higher power, somebody who's listening to that confession, might stop. And yet the human heart has this longing to confess and to get the guilt and the shame off its chest. And into this longing, I hear a voice speak. Because we all know that this world is broken. We all know that somehow the earth has kind of slipped off its axis and we want it to be set right. We want wars to stop and we want pandemics to cease and we want relationships to be made whole. We want broken bodies to be fixed up. And I hear that voice. I hear a voice, folks, that says, "I am making all things new." In a materialistic world, where can I find meaning? In a confusing world, where can I find guidance? In a broken world, where can I find liberation? And in a lonely world, question number 4, where can I find love? You know that the single-person household is now the most popular, if I can say that, most highest rating household type in Australia now, the single-person household. 25% of households are actually single-person households. Fastest growing segment as well, single-person households. Now, of course, all the 2 million people that live in those single-person households aren't all lonely, but a good deal of them are. The only mail they get is junk mail. The only email they get is spam. The only telephone calls they get are from telemarketers. That's why they're going up to strangers on the 436 bus. That's why they're paying fortune tellers for an afternoon's company. Now, of course, you don't have to be alone, single, living by yourself to be lonely. There was a research done a number of years ago, and it showed that the average Australian couple talks on average 12 minutes a day to each other. 12 minutes a day for the average couple in Australia. Hugh McKay made the very interesting point. He said, that's just the average. Some husbands and wives would find 12 minutes in a row to be an eternity. And so we're on a search to find love. And as our homes become more lonely, we're searching for that love on the digital superhighway. Look at the rise of MySpace and Facebook over the last 2 years alone. We may spend 12 minutes a day talking to our spouse, but 2 hours a day catching up on Facebook. We may have no confidants in our lives, and yet we have 400 friends on MySpace. Now, MySpace and Facebook are wonderful tools to keep up and catch up with colleagues and friends and family. It's wonderful things. But the research shows that the more time we spend on social networking sites, the less time we spend with flesh and blood people, whether our family or at social events. And so we have this situation where social technologies make us less sociable. You might have heard recently of a British woman who divorced her husband for finding out that his computer game character had cheated on hers. They were both members of the game Second Life. You heard of Second Life? Where people take on alter egos, avatars, and she found his animated character cuddling another animated character on an animated sofa and it's the first known case of divorce over virtual adultery that's actually ever been heard. Don't things get complex in our modern day and age? Nearly half of our first-time marriages, 70% of our second-time marriages in Australia will end in divorce, so it's no, I guess, surprise again that we're seeing an increase in popularity in prenuptial agreements. We're also having financial counsellors suggest that couples should have separate bank accounts, just to be sure. There's even a talk of running away accounts for women, just in case, so they won't be left in the lurch. The interesting thing is that 76% of Australian couples live together before they get married. You've got to say it's a sad day in Australia when love means that you can share your body with someone before you share your PIN number. Then, of course, there's sexting. We heard about that recently. New South Wales, the New South Wales government, you know, seen it to be such a problem. These young girls who take erotic pictures of themselves and SMS them off to their boyfriends, that they've started a campaign in schools targeting children and parents about the dangers of it. One expert suggested that girls as young as 12 were sexting. Now I ask you, where does a 12-year-old girl get the idea of taking a picture of her most private, intimate parts and SMSing it to the boy down the street? Where does she even get that idea from? It seems to me she gets the idea from a culture that trains its teens in sex education through Cosmopolitan magazine. And she gets it from a society that allows the raising of billboards like longer-lasting sex and sexpo and Portugasm is the latest one. I'm never going to buy Nando's again. I guess she grows up in a society where every single child will have seen pornography by the time that she's 15. I guess, in short, she gets the idea from a society that is mistaken lust-driven possession with self-giving love. And the funny thing is that humans are just built for relationship. We are just designed for friendship. We are designed to connect with others. Take somebody and put them into a room by themselves, isolate them, and over a period of time, you will see a number of things happen. They will become disillusioned and disoriented. They'll become confused. Their sleep will be disturbed. Their brain capacity will go down. Their intelligence will actually decrease. Their empathy for others will actually decrease. In fact, the researchers say they will genetically start to break down. One researcher suggested that chronic isolation is actually like premature aging. It does that to the body. We are somehow miraculously built to be relating to other people. It's part of our DNA. So no wonder young girls are looking for the attention of the boy down the street. No wonder we're looking for love on the digital superhighway. No wonder our hearts break even over virtual adultery. No wonder the longing is right, but the way that we're trying to fulfill it is leaving us in trouble. And so we ask again. We ask that question again. In a lonely world, where can I find love? And folks, can you hear a voice whispering? Can you hear a voice whispering, I have loved you with an everlasting love. Come to me. Four questions. One story. One reviewer called it one of modern cinema's most compelling and indelible love stories. Another reviewer called it a deep vat of sicky sentimentality. I don't know about you, but I have to confess to being a fan of the chick flick that actually was the film called The Notebook. Did you see it? Yes, all the women clap. Funny about that. The Notebook tells the story of two elderly residents in a nursing home. Duke comes along and reads a story to the ailing Mrs. Hamilton every single day, out of a handwritten notebook. Mrs. Hamilton is suffering from Alzheimer's disease. She can't remember her past. She no longer recognises her family when they come to visit her. She can't even remember that yesterday at the same time Duke came and actually read the same story to her. And yet faithfully he comes, notebook in hand, every single day to retell the tale he must have told 100 times before. And as he's telling the story, we have these flashbacks to the 1940s. To see the couple that this story is all about, this couple of young lovers who meet, fight, fall in love, and then lose touch. And every now and then we flash back to Mrs. Hamilton, and we see just this kind of quizzical look on her face, and she says something like, you know, this story does seem vaguely familiar. Flashback to the 1940s, we see the two young couples still separated, and he's writing a love letter to her every single day, and we see the girl's mother intercepts those love letters every single day so she never receives them. And Mrs. Hamilton says, you know, I think I might have heard this story before. towards the end of the story, Duke is reading out the last few lines, and that's where the two get together again, and we see something beautiful happen on the face of Mrs. Hamilton. Her eyes open, and she says, "Yes, Duke, I remember now. That story is about us." And for a few precious moments, she snaps out of her Alzheimer's disease, and she returns to reality, and she remembers who she is, who she's married to, Duke, who her family is, what her story is. Get this, in the telling of a special story, Mrs. Hamilton's confusion is interrupted and she returns to reality. Folks, we're confused. We're confused about meaning, guidance, liberation, and love. And yet Christians have actually been given a story that, when told faithfully and repeatedly, can interrupt our confusion and return us to reality. What is that story? Here's the story. Here's the story that can give some answers to those four questions in the soul of our nation. It's the story of a God who imagined earth and moon and sun and stars before each was created, who designed the atom, the DNA string, and matter's most basic elements. It's the story of a God who sketched dimensions on ozone layers and the mechanics of gravitational forces, who dreamt up air and water, ice and mist, who envisioned leaves and seeds and snowflakes and petals. A God who flung stars across the sky and set all the worlds spinning. A God who holds the heaviest planet and the lightest feather in his grip. It's the story of an infinite God who, in comparison, makes the vastest oceans look like the tiniest of droplets. A God found in outback beauty, peak hour traffic, a Canberra lounge room in a Kolkata slum. A God who attends to a shooting star, a Middle East war, a melting ice cap, and a little girl's prayer all at once. It's the story of a God who watches every sparrow, counts every hair, hears every cry, catches every tear. A God who reads every concern, witnesses every dream, knows every secret, foresees every outcome. A God with whom no cry goes unheard, no pain goes unfelt, no evil left unrecorded. A God who cannot be surprised. It's the story of a God who controls earth and sky, heaven and hell, proton, neutron, embryo, stem cell. A God by whom all in the cosmos is owned and by whom all in life is owed. That is the story that can bring answers to our questions. It's the story of a God whose one desire has always been to have a people for himself. And so this God designed the eyeball, the nervous system, skeletal structures and tendons. He cupped his hands and released humanity to love and build and run and sing. He scheduled our days before we were a thought. He knew what we'd do, and yet he still went ahead with it. It's the story of a God whom earth, sky, and heavens can never even hope to try and contain, yet the story of a God who squeezed his greatness into the body of a baby boy. A boy who became a man. A man who divided time. A timeless human being who gives our story a little bit more detail. Because here we see a God with wood shavings in his hair, with toes filled with dust and tears streaming down his cheeks. Here we see a God who seeks that one lost sheep and looks for that one lost coin and waits for that one lost son. We see a God who touches every leper, heals the most diseased, parties with the rejected, forgives the vilest of sins. It's a story of a God who prays in a lonely garden, is betrayed by the kiss of a friend, a God who carries a cross up a lonely old hill. It's a story of a God whose love endures taunts and splinters and spit and ridicule, for whom justice is twisted, yet he says not a word. It's the story of a God who, as angels wept and demons convulsed, had one arm, then the other arm stretched out wide, and who took rusty nails under a heavy mallet through both arms and through both feet. And a God who is lifted up and exposed to the world as a naked, bleeding, seemingly defeated God. And yet it's the God who rose back 3 days later and defeated sin and evil and death forever. It's the story of a God who comes to us in Jesus Christ and he says, "Yes, you're weary and burdened, looking for life's meaning. Come to me. Come to me. I made you to live with me. I made you to know me and enjoy me forever." That Westminster Catechism still sticks around. Enjoy me forever. Come to me and I'll open your eyes and show you just a little bit of what I see, and that'll be enough to put this world into perspective for you. It's the story of a God who says, "Yes, you are confused, looking for guidance in life. Will you come to me? Will you come to me? I'll give you values to live by. I'll give you a new heart to live from. I'll give you a voice to listen to. Just come to me. It's the story of a God who says, yes, this world is broken and you long for liberation of this evil world. You long to see all the evil and all the brokenness redeemed. You long to see your own guilt and shame fixed up. Come to me. I'm making a new world. I'm ushering in a new heavens and a new earth. I will heal you. I will forgive you. Come to me. It's the story of a God who says, you are longing for love. You are longing for love and I will give you an everlasting love. An everlasting love that will fill you and change you, overflow from you to everyone around you if you will just come to me. I believe that there's conservatively 150,000 students represented by you here tonight. That's of course not even counting the amount of young people that you have nurtured as the years have gone on. The American sociologist Robert Beller once said that a culture can change when 2% of its population get a new vision. Just 2%. Based on our current population, 435,000 people can change the face of Australia. And you, my friends, are dealing with 150,000 of them. Just imagine an Australia who responded to this story. Just imagine an Australia whose citizens find their sense of meaning not in big houses and flash cars and giant pay packets and in fame and success and me rings, but in a loving God, the God of love, and in love for neighbour and citizen. Imagine that. Imagine a nation whose citizens are led by values of joy and love and peace and kindness and goodness and self-control and perseverance. Imagine a nation of people attuned to the voice of the one who calls them into exciting vocations and careers. Imagine a nation whose citizens are fueled by a vision of a liberated world, the new heavens and the new earth that God is ushering all history towards. The kind of vision that leads them to pray every morning, your kingdom come, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven, and live and work each day as if that moment is just around the corner. Imagine a nation whose citizens and whose students, I might just add, are so wrapped up in their Heavenly Father's love for them that they don't fall for the counterfeits offered online. They don't fall victim and vulnerable to the attentions of the boy down the street and his fleeting fancies. But a love that guides them and a love that grounds them in their deepest relationships with their family and with their romantic partners and with their community. A love that leads them into a healthy sexuality of beauty and goodness and excitement. A love that leads them to give themselves to everyone around them, the least, the lost, the last. Imagine a nation like that. Well, indeed, the genesis of that kind of nation could well be sitting in your classrooms. Of course, not every single student in your classrooms will respond to this story that we've outlined tonight, and that's their freedom to do so. They need to have that freedom. And yet a good deal will, and I believe that because we're confused about meaning and guidance and liberation and love. And the story of the God of love is enough to interrupt that confusion, answer some of those anxious questions in our hearts. Open our eyes to see something beautiful and fresh. I salute you in what you do. I pray God's blessing that he will enable you to do exactly what we've talked about tonight. In Jesus' name, may it be so. Thank you very much.